Take your Bible, if you would, and look at the book of Daniel again, chapter 3. Daniel chapter 3. And we're going to read there in just a moment as we begin. As we mentioned a moment ago, you need the notes. I guess I shouldn't say if you need the notes. I guess in anticipation that you would like to use the notes this evening. You can find those on the back at the Welcome Center. Or if on your phone or watching online, you can go to our website to the Connect page and pull those up. And we're going to look at a very interesting passage of Scripture tonight. In my opinion, it is interesting. Our kids have a new kids book or kids lesson comic book that we've been printing with each of these chapters that we've been walking through with Daniel. And this one is probably not very unfamiliar to them, or really very unfamiliar to any of us. Most likely, most of us, when I mention Daniel chapter 3, and particularly we've labeled it this way, the fiery furnace. That's what we all know it as. And when we think of it, we will initially most likely think of it a few ways. Some of us learned it by Sunday school flannel graph board. Some of us may see it, or we may envision a particular children's book or like a children's Bible that illustrates it. If you're much younger than that, you may immediately think of talking vegetables because there was a show of talking vegetables that evidently made this story into a cartoon. For many people, the story is known in those ways. And most of the time, the lesson of this story, when that is the case, most of the time, the lesson itself is boiled down to a moral lesson of obedience to God at all costs. And that is a great lesson. That is a true lesson that is taught all throughout Scripture. But usually we refine it and so simplify it to the point of, here are some people that they were told they can't worship God, and they chose to worship God anyway. You should choose to worship God too. But this particular passage is dangerous and explosive in the context of our entire world. This is a global passage. We, as sometimes American Christians, can refine things to how they apply to us when we read the Bible. We read the Bible and say, how does this translate to my life? How am I going to face Daniel chapter 3 tomorrow? How could I possibly be called into that? The issue with that is, and it should be applied to our lives individually and personally as many times as possible. I had a conversation with someone recently who said, talking about taking the Bible in as a whole and certain things, they said, well, I just like to find the lesson for me. That makes the Bible more powerful than it is if you just read it as a whole. And I said, I would tend to argue with you. I think if you'll walk with me through the Bible as a whole, you will find it is very powerful because it addresses mankind as a whole and our entire world together. And if you really were to boil down and I were just to summarize what happens in Daniel chapter 3, I think we very quickly would not define this as a children's story. We would not talk about this like it is a kid's lesson of some sort. We would very quickly find, whether it's in our own lives or in the lives of literally millions of Christians who have lived around the world, millions of God's people, God's covenant people, believers around the world through the last several thousands of years of history, we would be able to summarize it, and it would not just be a kid's story. You see that there, that's sort of your first point. And I just want to give you an emphasis as to why. It shows a type of national idolatry and national identity that can turn into horror. You know, there's times when people group themselves together, they pool their resources, cultivate and develop things together, they seek security and refuge together, and that is fine, that is normal. We call those, in our modern day, we call those nations. In the time in which the Bible was written, they were called kingdoms. And remember, one of the main pressing themes of the book of Daniel is kings and kingdoms. And ultimately, God eventually setting up one kingdom with one king. And so you have this idea of nations or of kings and of kingdoms, and it's okay to have that. That is a natural way that God has given us to govern ourselves. But there are times when certain groups and nations or people rise to the place that they declare their way, their culture, as the best way and best culture, and even seek to stamp it with divine authority and say, this is God's way. This is God's culture, and even begin to impress it onto the cultures, nations, and influences of other people with the thought of our nation, land, kingdom, family, whatever it may be, is best, and you must be like us too. I'll read you a quote, a couple of quotes. Anyone ever heard of a man named Balder von Schrock? If you have, don't spoil it for everyone else. We have a couple of men in the room that I assume probably may have heard of him. He's a leader of national prominence and in a religious sense at times, and was trying to bring people together in unity and faced a lot of controversy for his particular beliefs about Christianity, about God, and about his nation. I'm going to read you a couple of his quotes. Here's what he said. Power is what spoils people. Yes, it seems to me that seeking after power is the great danger and the great corrupter of mankind. He went on to say, they say of us, talking about his movement, they say we are an anti-human, even anti-godly movement. They even say that I am an outspoken paganist, but I solemnly declare here before all and before the public that all I believe stands on the basis of Christianity. And then he goes on and he says this, he's speaking of Jesus. He says, if Jesus descended from heaven today, the great spiritual warrior who beat the money traders, you would shout, you're crucify, and you'd nail him to the cross that he himself bore. But mildly, he would smile upon your hate, saying, the truth will prevail, even if the bearer falls. The faith will live, for I give my life and stand tall at the cross for all warriors of the world. That was his declaration. Yet then he went on to say this in an interview with the London Times in the late 1930s. He says, I solemnly declare before the German public that I stand on the basis of Christianity, but I declare just as solemnly that I will put down every attempt to introduce confessional matters into the Hitler Youth. He who serves our Führer, Adolf Hitler, serves Germany, and he who serves Germany serves God. Fairly daunting words, aren't they? In our American world, we think evil, Germany, Satan. But here is a nation that was rising, that with everything in them, their leaders were convinced, this is of Jesus Christ. And there's a problem with this, because it obviously was not. Germany wasn't the first group to do this, and they aren't and won't be the last group or nation to do it. And when God's people, here is the key of tonight's lesson or the theme, when God's people find themselves living in a kingdom or a nation who does this, who idolizes their identity, or begins to act in a way in which they have divine authority and power, how do God's people respond? Or maybe people that live in a kingdom or nation who don't take the exact path as Nazi Germany, but they idolize their national identity in some other way, even a Christian way. What do God's people do? Now, does the passage have our attention this evening? It is no longer a kid's story. It is real life. Look, if you would, Daniel chapter 3. Nebuchadnezzar, verse number 1, the king made an image of gold, whose height was 80 cubits, and the breadth thereof 6 cubits. He set it up in the plain of Dura in the province of Babylon. Then Nebuchadnezzar, the king, sent to gather together the princes, the governors, the captains. And let me stop for a moment. I'm going to try to read this in the tone in which I believe Daniel is writing it. There are some things that are going to feel very repetitive, and it almost tempts us to just skip over them. But Daniel, I believe, is writing this in almost a mocking manner. He is looking back at how silly Nebuchadnezzar's edict, his decree, and his image were. And in my opinion, he's sort of writing this. He is continually repetitive. We'll talk about how repetitive he is in this chapter in just a moment. But I'm going to try to read it, maybe in the tone in which he would. So he says, Nebuchadnezzar the king sent together to gather together the princes, the governors, the captains, the judges, the treasurers, the counselors, the sheriffs, and all rulers of the provinces to come to the dedication of the image which Nebuchadnezzar the king had set up. Then the princes, governors, and captains, the judges, the treasurers, the counselors, the sheriffs, and all the rulers of the provinces were gathered together unto the dedication of the image that Nebuchadnezzar the king had set up. And they stood before the image that Nebuchadnezzar the king, or Nebuchadnezzar, had set up. Then an herald cried aloud, "To you it is commanded, O people, nations, and languages, that at what time ye hear the sound of the," take a deep breath, "cornet, flute, harp, sackbut, psaltery, dulcimer, and all kinds of music, ye fall down and worship the golden image that Nebuchadnezzar the king had set up. And whoso falleth down and worship shall the same hour, whosoever falleth not down and worshipeth shall the same hour be cast into the midst of a burning fiery furnace. Therefore, at that time, when all the people heard the sound of the cornet, the flute, harp, sackbut, psaltery, and all kinds of music, all the people, the nations, and languages fell down and worshipped," which thing? "The golden image that Nebuchadnezzar the king had set up. Wherefore, at that time, certain Chaldeans came near and accused the Jews. They spake and said unto the king, Nebuchadnezzar, O king, live forever. Thou, O king, hast made a decree that every man shall hear the sound of the cornet, flute, harp, sackbut, psaltery, dulcimer, and all kinds of music, shall fall down and worship the golden image. And whoso falleth not down and worshipeth, that he should be cast into the midst of a burning fiery furnace. There are certain Jews whom thou hast set over the affairs of the province of Babylon, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. These men, O king, have not regarded thee. They serve not thy gods, nor worship the golden image which thou hast set up. Then Nebuchadnezzar, in his rage and fury, commanded to bring Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. Then they brought these men before the king. And Nebuchadnezzar spake and said unto them, Is it true, O Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego? Do you not serve my gods, nor worship the golden image which I have set up? Now, if ye be ready, at what time thou shalt..." He just keeps saying this. "At what time you hear the sound of the cornet, flute, harp, sackbut, psaltery, dulcimer, and all kinds of music, ye fall down and worship the image which I have made. Well, but if ye worship not, ye shall be cast the same hour into the midst of the burning fiery furnace. And who is that God that shall deliver you out of my hands?" We'll stop there for a moment, and then we'll address the rest of the passage as we get to it. Let's ask the Lord to help us. Father, thank you for your word and its power. Teach us tonight from it. In Jesus' name, amen. So as we look, I want you to notice and try to kind of feel the tone, the context that I believe Daniel is really trying to set. That was a mouthful of a 15 verses. Truthfully, that probably could have been said in about 4 verses. Now, I am not doubting how Daniel wrote it, and I'm not doubting how the Lord has given it to us. I think Daniel gave it to us masterfully. He is emphasizing the ridiculousness of what Nebuchadnezzar has done. And he's doing so because, remember, our chapter and verse breakup in the Bible is not inspired. It's not given to us by God. It's not set out. It wasn't given with the original writing that Daniel... He just wrote the book of Daniel. And if you go back and look at chapter 2 and the end of the passage that we just studied last week, what has just happened? Nebuchadnezzar has been given a vision by God. A vision of a what? Everybody. Of a statue, of an image of, as we call it last week in a way, it's an idol. It's an image that is set up. What was it set up to display? What did the vision or the dream mean? It's an image displaying the power and authority of kings and kingdoms, and that it is displayed in an image, a false, if you would, a lifeless image, is to picture the idol or the idolatry that mankind makes over ruling over one another. And it shows the different empires that are going to come, the eventual nations that are going to come from those empires, and the desire that mankind has to rule over each other. And then eventually, God is going to set them all down, crush them, and under His own pressure, His kingdom is going to explode. There will be no room for any other kingdoms, and there will be only one king, and it will be Jesus Christ. That's the vision that Daniel has just given to Nebuchadnezzar. So I don't think there's any mistake or irony that the very next set of verses, Daniel says, and listen to what Nebuchadnezzar did next. He says he gets this vision from God. Here is a great idol. You're the golden head. Here are all these empires. God crushes and destroys them. There will be one king, and it is God forever. Nebuchadnezzar says, oh, I'm so glad that you've given me this vision. Here's what I will do. I will go out, and I will build a great image, a statue, and I will command everyone to worship the statue. Well, what did the image first represent in his dream? The idolatry of the nations, the idolatry of the power of humanity ruling over each other. I'm going to set up an idol and rule over people and make them worship the idol that represents my rule. I think that's what Daniel's trying to communicate, that this was foolish part on the part of Nebuchadnezzar. And so when he says all this, I just kind of imagine Daniel talking through what a hassle. And if you've ever been a part of any sort of, it doesn't have to be a government celebration, but any sort of massive celebration or party, you know that there are logistical nightmares for the people that actually have to do the work. My uncle is he works in different positions in the state of West Virginia and is able to kind of bump shoulders with people that have some say in different industries. And so, you know, the Greenbrier Resort is in West Virginia. And there at the Greenbrier Resort, they host every year the PGA. There's a PGA tournament there, the Greenbrier Classic. And so the governor of the state of Virginia actually owns the Greenbrier Resort. And he came out one time, about a month before the Greenbrier Classic, and to show support for our U.S. troops, he says, we're going to rename this. We're going to rename the Greenbrier Classic, and we're going to name it, I can't remember the exact name, but like the Salute the Troops Classic, or it was something about a veterans class. It was all about the troops, and it was about honoring veterans, which is a great cause. The problem is he announced it about 30 days before the tournament, when there had been thousands of brochures, thousands of t-shirts, every flag, every sign, every piece of direction all throughout the facility and the resort, hotel amenities that had been stamped and plugged. I mean, it was a logistical nightmare losing millions of dollars to correct this once he had sort of made this declaration. And I think Daniel is trying to relay to us that that is sort of the nature of what Nebuchadnezzar has just done. He declares, build this statue. And I want you to think about the image itself, that the details of the image. What was it? We don't know exactly what it was. We kind of assume maybe it looked like him, but doesn't really give us any inclination as to that. But it's an image made of gold. It's 60 cubits high, 6 cubits wide. Now that doesn't do anything for you. That means it's 90 feet tall, 9 feet wide. An image made of gold. My wingspan is about 6.5, closing in on 7. It's about 6.5 feet wide. Okay? So imagine me plus a little bit more building a structure that pencils up into the air 90 feet, but is only 9 feet wide. I mean, the fact that they could get it to stand without falling over was a logistical nightmare in and of itself, but it's plated with gold. So he makes this image, he makes it of gold, and you say, well, what was it? What did it represent? I don't know. It doesn't explicitly say. It may have been a monument to one of their gods. It may have been a tribute to the king himself. Nations have done that. Kingdoms have done that in the past. They make an idol. The Colossus of Rhodes, that was one of the wonders, ancient wonders of the world, was made to a god. And then there's other kingdoms that made statues to their kings and to their rulers. And then there are some nations and kingdoms that make big monuments to the embodiment of their ideals. I mean, we don't do that in modern day anymore, right? We don't put 100-foot-tall statues in the middle of a harbor, or couple hundred feet pencil statues in the middle of a city. We don't do that. Now, I'm not saying, don't go out of here saying James hates the Statue of Liberty and the Washington Monument. All I'm saying is that all throughout humanity, we have made monuments to our ideals and our pride as people, countries, and nations. So that's really what Nebuchadnezzar does. He raises this image, this statue, and that probably of itself is not a sin. The issue becomes in chapter 3, in verse number 1, 2, and 3, that it commands us, and he tells us in verses, he gives us the description, but then in verse 4 and 5, he tells us, when they play the music, bow down and worship this statue. In verse 6, he says, the one that doesn't worship this is going to burn in fire. So now you have an issue. It's not just that he's building a statue, an idol, if you would. He makes it an idol by commanding worship. It's not just that he's building a statue of remembrance of his God or himself or of their ideals, that's the issue. Now he commands and demands that people view this image as a deity or a symbol of divine power and to pledge allegiance by worship to it. Now you have an issue. Like, we would have an issue if our Constitution said once a year you got to go to the Statue of Liberty and kneel before it. Then we would have an issue. Now, right now we can just travel and wear funny t-shirts and take selfies with it, and it's not that big of a deal. But here is Nebuchadnezzar making this statement, if you would, about this particular image. And notice what it says next, the idolatry of it. Daniel speaks of the ceremony surrounding it, as we already said, with a mocking tone. Notice this. He uses the phrase that the king had set up, or he talks about the king setting it up, 9 times in 18 verses. Now, it's the same word used in chapter 2, verse 21, where it says that God sets up kings. And it says, and he giveth wisdom to the wise, or excuse me, verse number 21 says, he changeth the times and seasons, he removeth kings and setteth up kings. So he's kind of playing on words here, saying, God has just told Nebuchadnezzar, I set who's in power. But Nebuchadnezzar decides he's going to set up this idol, this statue. Same word 9 times. He repeats the names of the people invited in back-to-back verses. We didn't need to see that 2 times in a row to understand what he's talking about. But he does it to sort of emphasize the silly nature of what he's doing. I'm guessing he's probably reminiscing, thinking about how many times he heard this rule or this law announced. He's probably, you know, leading up to it months in advance, or however long it took. He's just repeating. He repeats the details of the call to worship, all the different types of music. He repeats that over and over. He uses the word worship 11 times to indicate Nebuchadnezzar's purpose, and you have the verses listed out there. But he also is doing this to justify the Hebrew boys, if you would, at this point, young men, to justify the Hebrew young man's response. Here's what Daniel's trying to set in the context of the story. There was a great image, and this great human earthly ruler told us to treat this image in a way that we have been commanded to only treat God. That's the real issue. And then he establishes that. He says, he told us to worship. 11 times he says the word worship. And he says, that is the final straw. That is where we draw the line. We worship none but God. He's pointing out the fact that this is idolatry. Nebuchadnezzar then commands that death by burning alive would be the punishment for not participating. I mean, think about it. We've been teaching this story, rightfully so, to our kids for years. But here is the premise of this story. An evil dictator ruler commanded people to build an image, an idol to worship, young children. And then he threatened that if they didn't worship it, he would burn them all alive. I mean, this is just a great bedtime story. So Daniel identifies the irony in Nebuchadnezzar's self-adulation and shows, here's what Daniel's trying to say all along through these first 15 verses. What Nebuchadnezzar did and what he declares, he is absolutely unworthy of. And here is what it communicates to us and to the rest of human nature as we read the book of Daniel. There is not a human being that has ever been born, there's not a human being that has ever lived that is worthy of what Nebuchadnezzar tried to do. It doesn't happen. No one has ever come along and established a government or done a deed or established a kingdom or done something for some humanitarian crisis. There is no one that has ever lived that has ever been worthy of what Nebuchadnezzar asks in these first few verses. So then you have this accusation is next. How did it all change so quickly? That's the point. Meaning, in chapter 2, verse 49, last verse, it tells us that Nebuchadnezzar takes these three young men and makes them three of the most powerful men in the entire world. Fast forward about 8 verses, and they're about to be burned alive. How did that happen? How did they go from kings and rulers of provinces of the most powerful empire in the world to we're going to be tied up and thrown into the fireplace? How is that going to happen? Well, you have the background, the idol, you have the image, you have the idolatry, and then comes this accusation. Notice, certain Chaldeans, there's always, I love that word certain, specific people. There are some, ever had this conversation with people? We don't do this like some people do. You know, this is what Daniel's saying. They made this command, the Hebrew boys did not obey, and then some people happen to notice that. So here's what they do. If I find myself on the right page, verse number 8, wherefore at that time certain Chaldeans came near and accused the Jews. So notice there's this accusation. What do they note immediately? Well, they declare their allegiance, their loyalty to the king in verse number 9, O king, live forever. Then they bring this accusation. They recite the king's decree back to him. Remember what you said. And in fact, Daniel gives it to us verbatim with all of these instruments again. And then they recite to him, they remind him of the punishment that he said. And if you don't, you're going to burn alive. And then they identify who has done this. Verse 12, there are certain Jews. There are some people whom thou hast set over the affairs of the province of Babylon. So they basically kind of blame Nebuchadnezzar for this. But then notice what they identify or point out. They do not serve your gods. They do not bow down to your image. But notice even before that, O king, they have not regarded thee. So here's what they said. They don't respect your rule. They don't love your gods. And they just don't care. They're not going to worship you. They're not going to bow down to the image. So they don't respect you as a person. They don't respect your beliefs. And they don't respect your work. Now, have you ever felt that you insulted someone or been insulted? They don't respect you as a person. They don't respect your beliefs. And they don't respect your work. This is highly offensive to Nebuchadnezzar. And so, here comes the threat and the test. Notice, if you would, verse 14. Nebuchadnezzar spake and said unto them, Is it true, O Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego? Do not ye serve my gods, nor worship the golden image which I have set up? Now if you be ready, and he repeats it all, we read this a moment ago. He says, if you do it, I'll give you a second chance, great. Maybe your ears were clogged. Maybe you were tending to business somewhere else. It doesn't even explain if they were out in the field and in the plains where everybody else were, if they were just in their homes. But if you don't worship, middle of the verse, ye shall be cast the same hour into the midst of a burning fiery furnace. And notice this phrase. Daniel just keeps artistically setting up these wonderful dramatic phrases. Who is that God that shall deliver you out of my hands? Remember, Daniel says in chapter 2, I can't tell you your dream, but there is a God who will do these things. Nebuchadnezzar sets them up for like easy softball pitch down the middle of faithful religious declaration to a God. He says, who is the God that's going to save you from my hand? And they say, actually, sir, verse 16, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego answered and said to the king, O Nebuchadnezzar, they do not say, live forever. We are not careful to answer thee in this matter. Now, what does that mean? It means we have no need. The word careful means a need or a burden. Cast your cares upon the Lord, the need or the burden. He says, we have no care. We do not care. We have no need. We don't have to answer you. So they've just told the king, we don't respect you as a person, we don't respect your belief, and we don't respect your work. And now he gives them a second chance, and they say, and we don't have to talk to you either. Like, we don't even have to bring this up to you. Verse 17, notice this. We do not have to be careful to answer thee in this matter. If it be so, meaning if what you do, if what you say you actually do, our God whom we serve is able to deliver us from the burning fiery furnace, and he will deliver us out of thine hand, O king. That is the most polite form of rebellion you may read ever. I mean, this not, no, you vagabond king of pagans and nasty, sinful, dark creature of a soul, you know. They don't do that. They just say, if you burn us, then our God might save us. But we're not going to bow down before you. And then notice verse 18. But if not, be it known unto thee, O king, that we will not serve thy gods, nor worship the golden image which thou hast set up. They make it very simple. If you throw us in the fire, God might save us. But if he doesn't, that's all you can do to us. Your power and authority ends there. And so we will not serve you. Then in verse 19, then was Nebuchadnezzar full of fury. Oh boy. And the form of his visage was changed against Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. And again, to notice that Daniel is a masterful writer. If you look at verse 19, notice where it says the form of his visage. The word used there is tselem. You know what other word tselem occurs throughout Daniel? Every time you see the word image in the book of Daniel, it is the word tselem. That Nebuchadnezzar sees a vision of an image. It's tselem. And then he builds an image that he set up. It's tselem. Now, Daniel is saying, when the boys said this to Nebuchadnezzar, his tselem changed. That's what they're saying. He's saying, his image completely changed. And he's comparing constantly, sort of under the surface, comparing God to Nebuchadnezzar. Here is God whose image does not change. Here is God who is unaffected by human rule. And here is this little man who thinks he is all-powerful. And three boys say, we don't like you, we don't like your beliefs, and we don't respect your work, and we don't have to talk to you. And just from those three young men saying that, he is morphed. He loses control. And so he says, his image was changed there in verse number 19. Against Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. Therefore he spake and commanded they should heat the furnace 1 7 times more than it was wont to be heated. And he commanded the most mighty men that were in his army to bind Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego and cast them into the burning fiery furnace. Then these men were bound in their coats, their hosen, their hats. I'm not sure what hosen is, but their hats and their garments, and were cast into the midst of the burning fiery furnace. Therefore, because the king's commandment was urgent, so in other words, because of his anger, the soldiers hurried. They didn't want to be thrown in too. And the furnace exceeding hot. Evidently, the men that were taking them didn't take the normal precautions that you would at a people burning. The flame of the fire slew... Shouldn't joke about that. The flame of the fire slew those men that took up Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. And these three men, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, notice this repetition here, Meshach and Abednego, fell down bound into the midst of the burning fiery furnace. Then Nebuchadnezzar the king was astonished or astonied. He was taken back, rose up in haste, and spake and said unto his counselors, did not we cast three men bound into the midst of the fire? And they answered and said unto the king, of course they would, and he's so angry and mad. True, O king, yes, we agree, yes, that is true. He answered and said, lo, I see four men loose, walking in the midst of the fire, and they have no hurt. And the form of the fourth is like the Son of God. And of course we know that you can speak this, whether some believe this is a personification of Jesus Christ himself. Remember, it is Nebuchadnezzar speaking, not a believer, and not knowing what Christ was to be. The word he uses there literally is a deity or divine being. Was it the actual physical embodiment of Jesus or what? I'm not sure. Later Nebuchadnezzar says an angel. It was an angel in the midst of them. But here is the point. Nebuchadnezzar thought he had control over all things. And he found out very quickly that he did not. What do you think about this? Fire throughout the Bible is often personified for pictures judgment and refinement. And Nebuchadnezzar thinks that he, rather than God, holds the key to the judgment of these men. So much so that he increases the fury of the fire to match the feeling of his wrath. And even though these young men remained faithful to God, they did not escape the fire of man's false judgment. And I think it's important to note that before we move on to the wonderful, good salvation part at the end. These young men understood they had not heard the gospel explicitly preached in the way that we preach the gospel today. But they knew there is a Messiah. He will come. He will make all things right. God will set up a kingdom eternally. And their understanding of the gospel, here is what it made them do. You see it there in your notes. The understanding of the gospel gave them the right mind here. They did not deserve the furnace of a pagan king. But they had already fully earned death. And this is important. Sometimes we think of ourselves as deserving of being immortal creatures, that we don't deserve to die, by whatever means it ends up happening. But these young men view death the right way. They say, we have not, they recognize, we didn't do anything really to really deserve to be burned alive at the hands of a pagan king, but we have done something that means we're going to die one day anyway. And so they don't rise up in revolt. They don't even necessarily hear, or it's not recorded, call out to God in anguish saying, how could you let this happen? They understand that the negative result that they are facing is because of who they are as human beings, because they're sinners. Not directly is it God's judgment and wrath on them, but an understanding of the gospel that all have sinned and come short of the glory of God, that the wages of sin are death, will help us understand that any unfairness in life is nothing compared to the judgment that we deserve from God. And so, even though they remained faithful to God, they didn't escape. Were they delivered from the fire? Yes and no, both. Were they delivered from going into the fire? No. Were they delivered from the fire? Yes. God does not stop them going into the fire, but He enters it with them. And there's a difference. I want you to think about this as we get ready to close. We know the story. We know what happens. We could spend all day, we could compare it to moments of our life. You could take this passage and say, when I get cancer, God's going to enter it with me. And that is a great truth. When my loved one passes away, God's going to enter that fire with me. And that is a great truth. When circumstances arise that seem to ruin my physical life, God's going to enter that fire with me. And all of that is true, and it is joyous. And we could stop there and say that that is the lesson. But I want you to think about this. From this moment on, Babylon in Scripture becomes this embodiment of the rule and authority of physical human kingdoms on earth. You read Revelation. What's going to be destroyed? Babylon is going to rise up and be destroyed. Do I actually think that there's going to be a nation called Babylon that rises? I don't necessarily think that that's going to happen. I think it's the embodiment of here is the rule and authority of man. So Babylon becomes this image of self-exaltation of humanity, and it represents the problem of any time any kingdom elevates its place in humanity to divine proportions and begins to declare its rule and law as something with divine blessing. Now, we may not feel that we are facing this at this moment right here today, but about 100 years ago, there rose up several nations that did this. And those people didn't think they were going to have to choose and make a decision as to which side. And so some of them were not prepared. There are recordings of people that we've read that were completely fooled by Hitler, by Germany, by the Nazi mindset that thought they were doing God's work. They didn't understand the difference between man's rule and God's rule. How do you know? How do you know when this comes to this place, when a country has brought themselves to this point? I want you to think about this. If you're more than 22 years old, you were born into the century in which more human beings died at the hands of other human beings than any other century in recorded history. And we think we were born maybe in the glory day of humanity. Quite the opposite. The bloodiest, most deadly century in all of humankind. And some of that's because of the number of population. But people have been fooled and duped and sucked into and seduced by the feeling of power. And not just, it doesn't mean that someone's going to promise and say, Brother Hampton, if Brother Hampton joins my side, I'm going to make him king of the United States. But here's what it might do, is it might say, if Monty will join my side, I'll make sure everything he values is elevated when I'm in power. That's a way that it is spoken to. That's a way that it speaks to us and tries to draw us in. And so here is what ends up happening. By banning the idea of God, there's countries that have banned the idea of God. But by doing that, they have made themselves God. How do you know that a nation has gone this far? When it begins to lose value of life. when it begins to devalue what a human being is worth, when it no longer sees human being as the image of God, but sees itself as the set up image of God. And human beings become expendable. Like for Nebuchadnezzar, three people, that's it, three people made him angry. And so they can be thrown away. And so you see this picture. So with this in mind, let's conclude with this. The story, call it a story, it's not a story, but this account of the salvation, the fire and salvation of these young men. What does it mean for us today? What does it mean for us when human beings, when we find ourselves in this position where people in power, nations, countries, ideals, whatever it may be, what do we do when we find ourselves in this conflict? And I want you to notice their response, and we'll be done. You can write some of them down. I gave kind of five, but you may find far more than that in the passage. What do God's people do? Well, this account, I want you to get this very clearly, this account advocates resistance to this thought. Very firmly, it advocates you should not buy into this. You should not agree. In no circumstance do you allow a human ruler to assume and assign divine rule, right, and authority to himself or his kingdom. You do not bow to that. So he advocates resistance, but I want you to notice this. He says, resist at all cost. The temptation to raise human ideology and independence to a place above and that ignores God at all cost. Resist. But I want you to notice how they did. First of all, there was peaceful non-participation. They don't withdraw. They don't hide. But they also don't immediately picket and declare war. There's this knife's edge of faithfulness to the Lord in this passage. Because the power of their resistance is actually found in their innocence. They are unblameable before Nebuchadnezzar. And it puts the pressure back on him. They did not go down to the golden statue and tie tarps and ropes and straps and try to cover it up. They didn't put explosives on their belts and run to try to destroy the image. They didn't murder people that were surrounding the image. They didn't play their own music to drown out the sound of the king's music. Here's what they did first. They simply did not participate. And the Bible teaches over and over, your allegiance is to Christ and Christ alone. Even if that means you do not participate. Peacefully, without blame. But that's where it begins. And so then they're brought in. Well, now it's a different circumstance. Notice they don't charge the king. They have unwavering resolve and unfaltering conviction, even to the place that a public statement is called out of them. So they start by saying, we won't participate in this. And it ends up with them having an audience before the king explaining why. And here's their essence of their statement. You can kill us, but that's as far as you can go. In a way, they're saying, if you kill us, it will display how little power you actually have. Think about the difference between Nebuchadnezzar and the Lord. Nebuchadnezzar says, disobey, you'll be punished by fire for a moment. God says, don't believe the gospel. Sin against me and be punished by fire forever. I can keep you alive. And Nebuchadnezzar says, I'll throw you in, you'll disintegrate, be dissipated, and you'll have, the three Hebrew boys say, you'll have no more authority over us. There won't be anything left of us for you to control. Yet God teaches us that in his divine judgment and justice, that people without Christ and the gospel are judged and tormented forever, completely within the reach of the God of the universe. Which one has more power? When you think about it that way, it will change how we respect someone that may hold authority over our lives and influence us. But they say they refuse to be defined by this. Their mission is to seek God and God's kingdom. I want you to look at Colossians 1, and we'll pray and be done. Look at Colossians 1. But it's interesting. They are called to follow God faithfully, but in doing so, they actually end up doing what is best for the kingdom of Babylon. Think about this. Where are they called from? Who are they? It's not that they resist completely in the sense of they'll have nothing to do with it. They literally have government jobs in Babylon. They rule over the provinces. They commune directly with the leadership of Babylon. There's nothing wrong with being involved in an earthly government. There is nothing wrong with being involved with earthly kingdoms and nations. But there is a line that must be drawn that says, no matter what you promise me, there is power that only belongs to the Lord. And so they come along. Augustine defined it this way. He says it's dual citizenship. You are part of an earthly kingdom, but you are a citizen of God's kingdom. And they say, we're going to do this not because their nation is best or their kingdom is best, but because Babylon exists under the rule of mighty God. Look at Colossians chapter 1. We'll read and be finished. A motivation for us to be like Nebuchadnezzar, to be like these three Hebrew children, not because they stood through the fire, not just because their clothes were not burned, not just because they are now legend of biblical proportions, but because our God is supreme. Notice this. Think about all these words with image. The word there is the same word from the same root word as tselem. Look at Colossians 1, look at verse 15. Who is the tselem? Who is the image of the invisible God? The firstborn of every creature. Who is it talking about? Jesus Christ. For by Him were all things created that are in heaven, that are in earth, visible and invisible. Whether they be thrones or dominions or principalities or powers, all things were created by Him and for Him. And He is before all things, and by Him all things consist. And He is the head of the body, the church, who is the beginning of the firstborn from the dead, that in all things He might have the preeminence. For it pleased the Father that in Him should all fullness dwell. So here is the image of God, the way it's supposed to be displayed. And how is that? Through a golden statue? No, and before we blame Nebuchadnezzar, think about this. I mean, Israel made golden statues too. God said, don't make any image of me because it's a creature trying to mimic the Creator. And I've already made one image. I've made mankind. You ruined it. So look at verse 20. How did the image display God? And having made peace through the blood of His cross, by Him to reconcile all things into Himself, by Him, I say, whether they be things in earth or things in heaven. You want to end on an encouraging note. When you look around the world tonight, and I don't know if you heard, there's some few nations here and there that aren't happy with each other, that believe one thing or another, that say one thing or another. And here's what Nebuchadnezzar was trying to do. Remember, he was the gold. I think that's why he made it all gold. I'm the golden head. So I'm going to build this golden image. And then when the silver and the brass and the iron and the clay nations come along, they'll be able to look back and say, look, remember when the golden image was here. But there's a problem. Nebuchadnezzar's image fell. It's not there anymore. My guess is it's destroyed, dissipated, and spread around the world. Some of it might be in Fort Knox. Who knows? There's only so much gold hanging around. It's gone. But there is an image of a king that was set up. We display it behind me. We put it on our Bibles. We represent it, and it is the cross. Quite the opposite from this image of gold that says, look how great I am. But this image of the cross in which Christ lifts Himself up to be seen by all, and it will last forever. To say, I have the rule. I have the power. Your kings, your kingdoms will all fall and all fail. Mine will never go away. And so tonight, though Russia is not knocking on our doorstep at the moment, though we may not feel like there is someone going to be at our house tonight to demand our allegiance, we can know that whenever that moment comes, for us or for whoever it is that says that they're a believer of God, they can look and say, I serve the real image. I do not have to bow. Your power only goes so far. And we can thank the Lord for it. Father, thank you for your mercy and your love. Thank you for your display in us, through us, and for us. And we ask that you guide and direct. Teach us from your word as we continue to study the book of Daniel over these next few weeks. And may you teach us. These are not children's stories. In fact, quite the opposite. They are stories for all of your children. They're calling us to bold, radical, God-centered, Christ-committed lives at all cost. And so may we not bow to ideology or identity unless it is in you. And we praise you for it in Jesus' name. Amen. If you would just take a look there at your prayer sheet.